Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our podcast, Afterlives of Ancient Egypt. I'm Kara Cooney, and today I will be joined by my sidekick, Amber Myers Wells. Amber, how you doing?
I'm okay.
We're both hanging in there, right? What are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about color in ancient art, and we're going to drill down a little bit more specifically ancient Mediterranean art, and even more specific to that, mostly sculpture. We can throw in some comparisons with some two-dimensional art, but what I think a lot of what we want to talk about today, it has to do with sculpture in the round, like 3D art.
Yeah, super, super fun, super interesting. Something that it really is a very emotional topic. You might be surprised to find this out as listeners, you're driving in your car or doing your laundry or whatever it is you're doing right now, to be like, wait, color in the ancient world makes people freak out. It does actually make people freak out. And Amber can tell us about this because you work at the Getty as an educator at the villa. So tell us how this would go down.
Yeah, well, I worked at the Getty Villa, and prior to that at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And you were there when I first started in 2005.
You were there. You too, Scarecrow.
Yes, and you too. So at LACMA, I found myself a lot of the time talking about ancient Egyptian art because that is why they would call on me, right?
Yeah.
But when I got to the Getty Villa, obviously that collection, it's ancient art, but it leans very heavily toward ancient Greek and Roman. There's some later Egyptian art in the collection, but Getty was very focused on that Western classical era.
Yeah, the objects that they have in the Getty, they are either Christian, very late, or they're Roman Egyptian, and they look Roman. Those are the things that were collected rather than the things that look Egyptian. They do have a mummy. The red shroud mummy, but that mummy has a face that looks very Greek/Roman. And so this was something that was palatable for J. Paul Getty to collect.
Right. And just for visitors in general, I've found that a lot of museum visitors, they're used to seeing color in ancient Egyptian art because it was preserved, right? The nature of the environment, the desert and such in Egypt preserved a lot more color and sculpture and other types of art from ancient Egypt. But when you're talking about Greece and Rome, it's a completely different environment, and a lot of that pigment didn't survive. And I ended up confronting this reaction by visitors head on when, I think it was 2008 at the Getty Villa, they had a show called The Color of Life. And that dealt with color and sculpture from the ancient world really to the modern world. But in that show, they had reconstructions of what some of this ancient classical sculpture would look like. So these types of marble sculpture that people were used to seeing in this very pure white suddenly was put next to this very brightly painted and colorful reconstruction. And people had this visceral emotional reaction. Usually it was distaste. They didn't like it. I would outright ask them. I was like, so, you know, which is more appealing to you, this white marble sculpture or this reconstruction? There were some people who were curious and they're like, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, I like the color. But a lot of people, the majority of them were just like, no, I like this. This is what I want to see. And so that always stuck with me. And I thought it would be interesting if we had a kind of a discussion about that, because there's this overarching Western European theme that was placed over ancient art from the Mediterranean world. So this ancient Mediterranean art from Egypt, Greece, Rome, it was originally brought to you in Technicolor. But then the elite Western European colonialists slapped a white filter on it. And this is what we have been, this is what has been programmed into our DNA with the Western aesthetic. This is what we have been conditioned to value. And so I thought we'd talk a little bit about why that is. But first, maybe we should cover some of the basics, like how do we know ancient sculpture was polychrome, i.e. had color?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one really awesome technical way to do it is to jerry-rig a camera that you have and make it into an infrared camera such that it can see the luminescence of Egyptian blue or any sort of pigment made with glass particles that luminesce. And you're able to then point and shoot, and you can see in the viewfinder of the camera the luminescence and the recorded photo, the digital photo as well. You can see that it shows up white in the photo. And then you're like, oh my God, this sarcophagus of dark black stone in the Museo Egizio in Torino had Egyptian blue all over it. And if it had Egyptian blue all over it, it would have had red pigments, yellow pigments, green pigments, other things that were then complementing that black. So that's for the Egyptian world. You can use technical means. You can use a microscope and point that at it and see if there's any pigments left remaining. There's one horror story, a very famous horror story, which you can all Google yourself, which is dealing with the Parthenon marbles in the British Museum, which used to have pigment on them, pigment preserved. They were pressure clean, and that pigment is now all gone. I also know of situations in which Sakhmet had red painted eyes in statue form in certain places in Egypt, and those were clean, and the red pigment is gone. So, you know, if you're dealing with an antiquity, it's almost always going to have dirt and grime and a varnish, a veneer of antiquity on it. And if you want it to be perfect and clean, museums would often take these things and clean them to give us the best state, something cleansed of all grime in a museum space. And we've lost a lot of color in that effort to preserve and conserve and restore. But it just takes some technological know-how or a very careful look with a human eye and something as simple as a magnifying glass and a flashlight, and you can see traces of pigment on ancient statues. And there's ultraviolet light, there's false color analysis, there's all kinds of new things. So you could take some of these statues and put it through other software. I don't think D-Stretch would necessarily help you with this, actually, but it does help with getting inscriptions. And there's another one called Fiji, which helps to separate inscriptions from other things. So it's, you know, there's lots of stuff that one can do to figure out what the ancient color was on a piece.
Yeah, the sciences plays a key role these days, but we can also just look at some of the ancient sources.
Yeah, you know,
you can have painted sources. And again, remember, we're also incorporating an ancient Greek and Roman sources, you know, where polychrome sculpture was depicted in maybe wall paintings or other art like vessels. There's also textual references to sculptures or to art that has color. And so that modern technology that you're talking about definitely augments and helps to confirm what we're seeing in the ancient sources, but the what they were doing with this art. And, you know, another aspect of what we're talking about here, there's not just pigment in some cases, but ancient artists also sometimes used colorful materials to add color to ancient art. So material embellishments like metal eyelashes, gilding, that kind of thing. And some of that was also removed, either deliberately or over the course of time and deterioration.
So, you know, it's a cool thing. You can look at a wall painting from Pompeii or Herculaneum, and you can see an image of a statue that has color on it, that is painted. It's not just one color. So you can even look at elements of the ancient world, even if the color on a given statue is not preserved well enough so that the naked eye can perceive it. But the thing that I like to also look at is think of how objects in religious ritual spaces are used today as well as the ancient world. And if you have a statue that is of a holy person or some sort of ritual is focusing on that statue is going to be dressed or embellished or cared for in some way. And if you go to Roman Catholic churches in Spain and Italy or Mexico or Peru, you will see these statues are paraded around, and often before they're brought out in a festival on a feast day, they'll be painted and cared for and dressed. And if you go to India and you go to a Hindu temple and you go to a space where there are statues of divinities, those statues are regularly repainted, updated. The wall paintings are regularly updated and repainted. It's not like we think of it in the Western world that you paint the Sistine Chapel and then you're done. you paint it and then you repaint it and then you repaint it. But because we have this idea of art that is of a masterpiece by an artist who is a master, that it must be preserved no matter what, it's made it all navel-gazing, androcentric human creation. And I think this is part of the question you asked before that will haunt this discussion. We'll get to it. But like, it's more about that and that form and that purity form or the original creation of that master and less about the ritual use of the piece. But if you go to a place where the object may not be the most pretty thing you've ever seen, it might be capably made, but not the most gorgeous Jesus you have ever seen, that Jesus will be lovingly repainted every year. Maybe a new crown of thorns placed on his head to do a passion, a series of feast days to celebrate Lent and all of these things. So I like to think of it as a very active sort of thing and really remove the artistic burden that we feel from the discussion, because this artistic burden of how dare you repaint a Michelangelo? Well, okay, yeah, once Michelangelo's on the walls, I don't want you to repaint it either. I get it. The master was pretty fucking awesome. But if we're talking about a statue in a temple space that is receiving ritual, that is having milk poured on it, as I saw once in a Hindu temple for the goddess Kali, then you're going to have to repaint that thing with that kind of daily offering to her. And so, you know, these things need to be they need their makeup put on. They need to be redone.
Revivified.
You don't want something with flaking paint. So it's the purpose of a piece is very important too. And if it's of a dead guy in a tomb, yeah, of course his paint's going to flake off and no one's going to care after a couple of generations. So it's a different purpose. And so we need to think about why these things exist, right?
Yeah, those are all great points. And actually the ancient perspective on art or sculpture in particular has a lot in common with non-Western ideas about color and art. But in the ancient world, it was really seen as something that was enlivening, right?
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that it wasn't in some way idealized or presented within a particular artistic canon, as with ancient Egypt. Those ancient artists and patrons had their agendas as well. But that color was a huge part of it. Yeah. And to remove it as the Western European aesthetic did, really separates the art in some way. It sort of intellectualizes it, takes it into a different category, an elevated category, kind of along the lines of what you were saying. Like, it's not necessarily down here with life and the daily grind. It's up here as something to be admired and aspired to.
I would also add a level of connoisseurship to this in that you're talking about something that you own, that is in one's possession, or that is valued for its material wealth and in its structure. So if you're looking at a sarcophagus and made of granodiorite stone, people would be like, why the hell would you paint? That stone is worth $1 million in the ancient Egyptian world. And they would be right. Why would you cover that stone with paint? You're showing everyone how much wealth you have. Or if you have a coffin of cedar wood, why would you then cover that? Or a statue of cedar wood, why would you cover that? And so it's also important where rich people are concerned, because rich people are making all of this stuff. Even if it's a simple statue of Jesus that's in a simple village church, it is the richest person or the richest people who are commissioning that and giving it as a gift to the church. Or the church itself is somehow able to get that money from the Vatican or whatever it is. These are things to display wealth and power. And so you layer that wealth and power and you get a precious material, maybe bronze in some cases, and you paint part of it, you repaint part of it, but it's there to layer on power and to layer on, maybe even to cover up part of it to say that I can do this, not to cover the whole, but to cover sections of it, and then to layer on the humanity. I love your idea of enlivening. That's the coolest. This idea that you're kind of putting skin and flesh and skin and hair and on the statue, you're giving it the breath of life. The Egyptians invented the opening of the mouth ceremony. Putting paint on is actually part of that ceremony, applying pigments and applying certain things to enliven it. The opening of the mouth ceremony is quite long and includes things like varnish and other things. It's complicated.
Yeah. So, yeah. When I would take visitors into the galleries, particularly the galleries that were filled with all of this plain white marble sculpture, I would point out to the people I was talking to, look, if an ancient person walked into this room, an ancient Greek, Roman, Egyptian, whatever, they would be horrified by the lack of color. It would look void and ghostly. And what is the point? That color being missing for them would smack them in the face hard. Just like the presence of color on that type of marble sculpture smacks the modern Western aesthetic square in the face.
Right.
So there is
such a smear of primitivism given to the ancient craftspeople and commissioners when we say, oh, we know better. We cleaned the Parthenon marbles that it's dirty, that shouldn't be there. I have to believe that they knew there were traces of pigment on there, but that there was a Western aesthetic and a Western, we know better accusation of primitivism, that the colors were added after the master created the marble and were not a part of the original piece. And then you're there in a connoisseurship mode, evaluating which part of the artistic ancient product is of most value that you shall save. It's the same with coffin reuse or a reused statue. Which is of the most value to you, the original attestation or the later attestation? And how do you work through that? And it's the same with the additions of color.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to get into that, but you are inexorably drawn to power. And so we're going to get to the power discussion because I feel like I cannot hold you back any longer. So let's dive into this, but allow me to guide you somewhat.
That's awesome. Please guide me
as we go in. Well, just because I want to hit some of these more interesting points that you're pinging here and there, but let's make sure that we nail them home.
Okay.
Drive them home. So this whole white marble idea, this aesthetic that was imposed on the Western European mind, is a lot of people will look back and they'll point to the neoclassical movement of the late 1700s and early 1800s that was really into reviving the ancient Greek and Roman styles and really started to develop this taste for white marble that followed us into the 19th and 20th centuries. So the question that you've been touching on here and there is why, right? Because this isn't something that was a result of ignorance. Mm-hmm. Even back to the Renaissance, Western Europeans knew that ancient sculpture was polychrome. They knew that there was color and they could read about it in the ancient texts. So even if there weren't archaeological discoveries at the time, they knew of it, right? And actually, Pompeii was first, like back in the 1500s, I think, was the first time it was initially encountered. It wasn't officially excavated until 1738 or something like that. But it was not from ignorance. So we can't look back and say, oh, well, they're just assuming that it's white because all of the color wore off, right? And then because as you said, they found it. They found traces. They deliberately power washed it, cleaned it off, scrubbed off any of the accretion that they found. So we know it wasn't because they didn't know about it. And so one of the points I think that you've been hitting on has been that taking the color away takes it from being pagan to Christian, something more palatable to a Christian society. So there's the religious aspect.
Which is crazy. Stop there. I want to settle into the differentiation between a 14th century Italian Renaissance experience and a 16th century Italian Renaissance experience. Because I wrote my book, The Cost of Death, inspired by Michael Baxendall's painting and experience in 14th century Italy. It was a book about artistic commission and workshops. It was a book about the commissioner setting up a contract with the artist and stipulating how much ultramarine blue, which is ground up lapis lazuli, as expensive as you can get, and how much gold you would include in a particular altarpiece or image of some kind. And these things were stipulated by price and by weight of material. And the artisan then had this to work with and then had to make sure that this much ultramarine and this much gold was included. So in a 14th century experience, painted things, brightly painted things, was incredibly important. And then you move into the 15th century, and then at the end of the 15th century and into the 16th. And again, dear listeners, I am leaving my area of expertise. This is not Egyptology, so please write in and correct with anything that you would like. But you get your Michelangelos and your other sculptors of the time sculpting things with the notion that it's really not meant to be painted, because Michelangelo's David is not meant to be painted. His tomb piece of Moses with horns is not meant to be painted. And these were highly polished pieces so that you could look at the shape of the body and the polish of the piece, and putting paint on it would mar. He appreciated color, Michelangelo. Obviously, he painted the Sistine Chapel. He was a painter as well. And these things could work with the same artist, but there was an interest in separating media and separating the paint from the sculpture, taking the sculpture out of the realm of the painted 2D was like this fantasy realm that Raphael could go into, that Da Vinci could go into. And they made, you know, the School of Athens that's visible in the Vatican today, or they made the Last Supper, that's Da Vinci, right? And you're able to go with perspective into this painted world. But then when you philosophically and ontologically, when you're in the space of the three-dimensional, somehow you're not supposed to sully the stone with the painted realm, that these things become separate. And why you have this hard categorization, and why this is associated with Christianity, because that's where I'm like, wait, stop now. Because Christianity, I mean, really, I think it's Reformation, Luther's Reformation, and then an anti-Reformation, where color really becomes part of icons and part of this idea of magic and how an object works magically, has to be repainted, has to have milk poured on it in the Hindu system, whatever. But like, you know, it has to be a statue that you put a crown of thorns on. Once you move into a Protestant realm, you leave all of this behind. You have to abandon color. And churches around the realm were whitewashed. They were plastered over. And some of these churches, like, you go into and you can see the old colored images underneath the whitewash, the iconoclasm of the Reformation movement. And then a Vatican reaction to it, a Roman Catholic reaction to it, would be like, okay, fine, we'll continue to do things in color, but we see that this has become something that is considered decadent, bad, falsehood, associated with buying your way into heaven or something else. And it's a very deep psychological state that I find really interesting. You can track it when in medieval to Renaissance Europe in particular. And of course, our art history and our understanding of color is a result of all of that.
Yeah. And in particular, talking about this Catholic / Protestant mindset, I can see from the Christian mindset, this idea of that realism that color lends to sculpture. If you take the color away, it's less idolatrous.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's not an idol anymore, or rather less so. And as you were talking there, I was also thinking about Vincent Brinkmann. He has done a lot of research on this classical sculpture and color reconstructions, along with Ulrika Brinkmann, who I assume is his wife. I think so. And he talks about this intellectual beauty of this purified white sculpture. And he absolutely agrees with this idea that white was an ideological choice by Western Europeans. Unlike you, he kind of walls himself in. He's like, that's not my field. Like, he doesn't want to go there and get into all of the messiness.
This is what podcasts are for.
Right, exactly. And so he definitely sees it, or would agree with this idea of this white imposition as being an imperial or colonialist elimination of color, a racial purification as well, which you touched on when you talked about indigenous or native art being more associated with color. And
with
not
the primitive, with the primitive.
Exactly, and something that wasn't intellectual or divinely inspired, right? Yeah, again, like I mentioned earlier, like this whiteness sort of elevates, right, in this ideological perspective. And so, yeah, I think that's a really important perspective to have on the white sculpture. And hopefully for listeners that haven't really thought of it this way before, the next time they go into a museum, those white sculptures are going to strike them in a very different way as they're right. walking through the galleries. And
take it a step further, Amber. So we were talking about Italy. Now move your gaze over to what has helped to create the United States and North America, Canada and North America. Go to Britain and go to this place that created its own Reformation of a different style, led by Henry VIII, but its own Protestant anti-Vatican movement in which churches were also whitewashed. Maybe not to the same extent, but there was a new aesthetic created. And then shortly after that, with Elizabeth II and then onward after the Civil War, you have empire. You have a British empire unlike anything the world has ever seen. And this anti-papist, anti-primitivist, as you invade and exploit places in Africa, Asia, and the New World, it becomes a British aesthetic. It becomes a neoclassical ideal when Nelson's navy is roaming the seas and the British Empire is really, Napoleon is beaten and they're reaching the broadest extent ever. There is the German word is Sehnsucht. There is like a longing for the old colors. And so, when Napoleon's savants get back from Egypt and they have all this material and the Rosetta Stone comes in. Well, let me stop at the Rosetta Stone for a second, because I have some things to say there. But they get to use Egypt and consume it, put it in their museums and say, this is the primitive other that we are not, but we are rulers over. Egypt is in their domain. They control it. And these colors differentiate themselves from us. And then this is the British Museum. You go in, you turn left, that's where Egypt is, right? You go to a different gallery. You go to the Parthenon marbles called the Elgin marbles in those days, brought in during these days of empire. The whiteness is their inheritance from this Greek perfected past. And yes, it is differentiated, right?
Yes. Yeah. Pause there for just a second, because that's exactly what I was thinking is, like you say, Egypt is owned and consumed. In a way, ancient Greece and Rome is as well, but it's we are the ancient Greeks. We are the ancient Romans. Yeah. That is our inheritance. This is how they're identifying, right? We aren't building our Supreme Court, Capitol, the White House to look like ancient Egyptian temples. They're built to look like ancient Greek and Roman architecture. And that Western patriarchal imperial identity is made in the image of ancient Greek and Roman architecture.
And that architecture, we know, would have been bright blue, bright red, bright yellow, bright. But who settled and created the United States? But a bunch of crazy lunatic Puritans with their Protestant ideals. And this United States Protestantism really created an architecture and an aesthetic of white purity. And that white purity, is seen in Supreme Court buildings, as you say.
And it makes it so much easier to see the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans as white, which, as we know, is complicated.
Yeah.
Right. But it was an ideological imposition, and it was something that helped Western European culture identify themselves with the Greek and Romans. But go back, U-turn. What were you going to say about the Rosetta Stone?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Good job. I think the Rosetta Stone, because I was just thinking, and a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, you can read your Brinkman, you can read, and I have a bibliography of stuff that I found from University of Michigan Kelsey website from an exhibition there that I think will be really helpful for listeners. We can put that link in our show notes. But thinking about how we value and fetishize certain Egyptian objects, particular Egyptian objects, and the Rosetta Stone is arguably the chief fetishized piece, maybe the bust of Nefertiti.
Nefertiti, that's what I was going to say.
Right? And she's painted and brightly painted and painted with skin tones that people argue over. And yet when it's represented on a German postage stamp, all that color goes away and they actually white out her face in many of those postage stamps or remove the color and just create the iconic outlines. But neither here nor there. It's interesting that of the two most fetishized objects, one is a painted lady. And the other is this icon of Western intellectual ability, and it has no paint on it. They did add a white pigment, the museum curators, such that you could see the text more clearly. So this kind of whitish paste, and I don't know what the material was that was put in there. It's since been removed, but it was put in there to make the text more legible. Of course, in the ancient world, it would have been painted with something else. It would have been, maybe there was Egyptian blue in there. We're never to know because they stuck some shitty white paste in there and then removed it. And that thing's been through a whole lot of conservation. But I think one of the reasons we value it is because it is just that dark stone. And when we cleaned it, when the Westerners, I say we, the Westerners, when that was cleaned, it was cleaned to then be the purity of the stone again, that expensive stone. Not trying, I don't think anybody's put up a Rosetta Stone exhibition that would show how it was painted in ancient times. Not that I've seen. I know I have seen reconstructions in publications, but I haven't seen anything in the museum itself, and nor would I expect it. But I think that's one reason, according to these rules of purity, superiority, white supremacy, I think it's one way of fetishizing and connoisseurshiply owning it in a way.
Well, and let's point out as well that this ideological imposition is in no way obligated to us to be logical, right?
No.
Where it seems like, oh, well, this is okay, but that's not okay. Like, painted Nefertiti is okay, but this painted sculpture of Heracles over here, this is not okay. It's under no obligation to make any kind of a sense because it doesn't, right? It's ideological. Right. It's just what is acceptable versus what is not. And it's largely based on just a feeling almost, right? This makes me uncomfortable, or this I feel that I can identify. It feels safe and I can identify with it, and it fits into my conception of the world and where I fit into the world. And so I think it's a good thing to point that out, because I'm sure a lot of people are like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
No, it's not a mathematical formula.
No, you know? No, it's not. And Nefertiti, I could bring in a feminist screed and say that we value her as a painted thing because she is meant to beautify our spaces and our minds. She is there as an object of a different kind of connoisseurship that's supposed to please us in a different way. The other is meant to be stripped down to its basic intellectual ability to crack a code, to be able to use the Greek to formulate what the ancient Egyptian was and to show the superiority of the Western mind. That's the reason that piece is so hotly contested and why the Egyptians want it back. It's used as another tool of claiming the primitivism of the others they conquered.
Yeah, and in many ways, it fits with that Western aesthetic of a more realistic kind of sculpture, the kind that Michelangelo was known for. It looks very real. And so that kind of jives with the Western aesthetic in any case. But yeah, Nefertiti, just as I experienced in that Color of Life exhibition, like, people are affected whenever they see that piece. And so absence of color, presence of color, it really changes the way people feel about something.
Yeah. And the way something comes out of the, well, there's the way something comes out into the public eye. And if it's like a bleached, ruined antiquity, then it's, we also want it to stay that way. We don't want to put it back into the realm of life. I also think that we are more comfortable keeping antiquity ancient.
Let's pull back on that a little bit, because I definitely want to get to that aspect of the discussion. But I wanted to throw in something that I know you are interested in talking about, which is, there were a couple of points in Western European history where this color and art and ancient art discussion had a little bit of a change, which was the discovery of Pompeii, as in when they actually started excavating it, and wow, all of the color that was coming out as they were uncovering that. But then also later in 1922, the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb by Howard Carter.
Yeah.
A lot of color there. And we know the explosion of Egyptomania that happened after that discovery. And so color got factored in there a little bit more heavily than maybe it had been in the past.
Yeah. It's such an interesting thing, because both moments of European Egyptomania, whether it's the Napoleonic creation of the Encyclopedia and the Description de l'Egypte, or the 1922 discovery of Tutankhamun, I mean, both of these were European-led and British-claimed, either through war or through wealth, through war.
Yes.
So it's so much about empire and so much about a white supremacist control over others that I think the two have to be put together. Because if you open up a description de l'Égypte and your listeners, you can get a Tashin copy of the plates for not very much money. It's a wonderful resource to have in your home library. So look into something like that. But you flip through the pages of this early 19th century volumes, which were, they're kept in certain libraries. I've seen an actual copy in the American Research Center American University in Cairo library. And it's insane, this publication, all the flora, all the fauna, and all the antiquities. And the antiquities, the temples, many of which have since been destroyed in lime kilns because of the Industrial Revolution coming to modern Egypt, they're gone. But you get these bright colors preserved. And it's such an interesting thing that at the same time you get this neoclassical movement, you have people gravitating toward this brightness and further differentiating their white, stark, pure aesthetic from this brightness, and then taking that brightness into different realms, into home decor, into fashion of the body and personal adornment and jewelry, but architecture and statuary were separated out, right? So that it affects some things, but not others. And then Tutankhamun, I would argue, you get the same kind of balance with things where you've got an incredibly wealthy British aristocracy able to fund an excavation like this, same time that the United States is up and coming, but this is before the 1930s collapse. Everyone's doing pretty well at this time, and there's a lot of wealth that's being thrown around. And to find something that is so over the top ostentatious, Egyptomania could only go so far into how people used it. People didn't start creating too many public works that would have followed this kind of aesthetic. They instead put some things in their homes, or again, body adornment, jewelry, clothing, hairstyles, other kinds of fashion were inspired by this, but too much was considered too gaudy. And so there was also an interest in cleaning up some of these things. So you do see some buildings where you might have a wall painting of Egyptian things. Or if you look at your Egyptian neoclassical paintings and from 1922 on into the early 20th century, you see a cleaned up whiteness given to Egyptian figures like Cleopatra or different kings or different elements in the ancient world, and an aesthetic that is imposed from a cleaner typology, if you like. So the color's there, but it would only go so far. And we still, I think, to this day, consider a lot of Egyptian brightness to be problematically gaudy. Like when you go to India.
Like the Egyptian theater in Hollywood. Yes. A lot of people saw that as kind of gaudy. You see that Egyptomania color in the context that Western culture is comfortable with, right? You were talking about home decor, clothing, jewelry.
Right.
We're cool with that bright color there. But then the Grauman's Egyptian theater in Hollywood, it's like, ooh, that's a little garish.
But yeah, so two things. Like I'm still coming back to India as a really good living comparison, because you see people in India maintaining a brightness to their clothing, to their temples, to their spaces, no matter what, right? But you could bring class issues into that. But then, so I think we should continue to look at India as an analogy here. But what did really draw Westerners into Egyptian aesthetics was the white clothing. So that
all the linen.
That linen, yeah. That stark linen garment without any color applied, and then you surround it with colorful elements, that worked well. That was a palette. That was a thing that could be manipulated. And there is that was aesthetically pleasing, I think, for an
1980s
audience.
Well, and the irony is linen was one thing that the Egyptians really couldn't add color to, right? Because linen doesn't really hold dye. So it was like, it maybe would have been colored, but this material doesn't really work with it. And maybe that's also why the Egyptians associated it with their Sunday best, quote unquote.
I mean, Amber, you're totally right. This is... The Egyptians would absolutely compare themselves, like the British using the British Museum and the Parthenon marbles versus other objects. They would show tomb scenes like from Beni Hassan, where you see the people coming in their coats of many colors. They're there in wool, which takes a dye really well, gets really bright
And they're there. A great contrast with those other, right? Those others.
Those others, and they're there in their bright garments, and the Egyptians are there in their white, pure garments. And in the tomb, that space of ultimate purity, wool is not supposed to be allowed. Or in the temple, wool is not supposed to be
That's
there.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. So there, this is not new, of people differentiating themselves using color on their bodies or in their architectural spaces to say, no, we would never. That's for the other people to do. And the Egyptians excelled on that in terms of body adornment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to make a note of that because I think we should also do an episode on the symbolism of color in ancient art. We can get into that and fall down the rabbit hole in ancient Egyptian culture. We can throw in some classical references as well. But
yeah,
I think that would be a really fun discussion to have. Something else that I think in the past you brought up as an interesting, a couple of interesting points when you're talking about the material from Tutankhamun's tomb. Is one, in a lot of cases, there are a lot of precious materials, a lot of expensive materials, but you've pointed out in the past, a lot of it's glass, right? So not necessarily the most precious material, but is more, it's colored glass, like more meant to be mimetic, right?
Reflect
this color of more precious materials.
Right. I mean, this is the human conundrum. Is the really well-made fake Gucci bag as good as the real Gucci bag? No. And I'm not into handbags, but I have a friend who is, and she's like, oh my God, you can get, what's it really, the Birkin or whatever? Is that, I think it's like a bag.
You're asking me,
like,
really?
I know. Oh my God. That can, because I don't know. I think it's a Birkin that can cost like $10,000 to $20,000. She's like, you can get a fake Birkin. And it's amazing. I'm like, okay, good for you. Go get that Birkin. But, you know, going back to the Michael Baxendall book, they are differentiating very clearly. It has to be this grade of ultramarine. It can't be Egyptian blue, which is made of glass. We want the real shit. We want the stuff that's made of lapis lazuli. And because it's in a religious context, the difference is important. You can't fake it. And if you fake it using yellow and varnish instead of actual gold leaf, then does it work in the same way? But And you're already like,
well,
yeah,
let me point out the ancient Egyptians, they also have in very elite tombs, say a wooden shaped vessel painted to look like some expensive porphyry or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so my understanding has always been, yeah, it's this wooden dummy here, but through the religious magic, it is transformed in your tomb when you're reborn to being the real expensive porphyry vase. Right.
Right.
So the orange-colored glass maybe becomes actual carnelian, right? These things that are inexpensive, things mimicking the expensive, become real. The ancient Egyptian mindset, at least that's always been my understanding.
And I think you're absolutely right, but that doesn't remove, in my opinion, it doesn't remove the social competition such that if we go into a Theban tomb, and we're in the ancient times, we get in our time machine, go back in time, we go into a Theban tomb, it's the Day of the Dead, everyone's visiting other tombs, it's awesome, it's a good time. And we go into one, and we see what you're talking about, a false door made of, it's painted, it's 2D, but it's painted to look like red granite with all the veins and the occlusions that a red granite stone would have. And you're like, oh, okay, this is nice. And the craftsmanship is gorgeous. The great painter, you're like, this is really nice. And you're like, oh, thank you for the beer. Okay, I'm going to go on to this other tomb. And you go up to the super high elite's tomb, who's got the real motherfucking thing. And he's got the red granite false door in his tomb in place on each side. Maybe he's got two of them, right? Maybe he's got a dark granodiorite one and a red granite one on dip for the east and the west, the rising and setting suns. And he's like super fancy. It doesn't mean that the one that's painted to look like red granite doesn't function. But it does mean that the millionaire is marked as such and has marked himself as such.
Oh, so point taken, for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, but then how do we deal with this when we're looking at something like Tutankhamun's tomb? Because he's a king. He is supposedly lesser than no one. He is the state. It is him. And there are elements in his funerary assemblage that show much less value in materials than others. But you still see choices being made such that there is way more glass used in the coffinets to contain the organs than precious stones. I think it's all glass and gold, right? And yet, if you look at the coffin set, you'll start to see some precious stones. You're like, oh my goodness, there's some lapis lazuli and there's some carnelian.
but you also see choices made about where to put it. So you'll do the beard in lapis lazuli because the beard is a god in and of itself. I know this seems weird to our dear listeners, but if you're not acquainted with Egyptology and how this can work, the crown is its own divinity. The beard is its own divinity. And so you want to
more visible,
that,
right? More noticeable.
And more visible and more noticeable. It is a focal point of the piece. So you want to make sure that part is made of real lapis lazuli. People can look at it and go, ooh, it's real lapis lazuli. Are they going to investigate the feet inlay to see if there's real lapis lazuli there? Probably not. They probably won't get the opportunity to, depending on where they are in the audience. So you only need to push it so far in some cases. But again, Tutankhamun was a nothing king compared to the Ramses IIs of the world.
You know also that, again, you are touching on a much more complicated issue because in the case of Tutankhamun, we're dealing with reused material, yeah, at least for some things, yes. And so who was it originally intended for? What was their rank? What was the original outlook for these pieces when they were created? You know, for instance, if they were, anyway, let's not go there. Okay.
But in short, getting back to your color question, material and color are inextricably linked. You cannot separate them. So a red carnelian stone is red. It's not called Deshret. It's going to be called carnelian, which I can't remember right now. I'm ashamed, but it's okay. We can look it up later. But it's, you know, and the materials can sometimes be associated with the color itself, and you get that color replicated. But the Egyptian creation of glass really was a magical, technological strike of genius to create color out of sand and using certain minerals.
This is an interesting point because technically we don't know exactly how they viewed this glass. Was it viewed with a little bit more cachet, shall we say, because it was a technological advancement?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you have your precious stones, but this glass, this is new technology. So let's incorporate that. Let's show that off because that also makes a statement.
Glass also catches light. So it catches, and what is color? You can't, color doesn't do shit if it's not in light, in some kind of light source. It's not going to work if it's hidden away in some dark, gloomy museum, which we could talk about as well.
Exactly. But, you keep doing this. They're much more complicated topics.
but with the glass, like pulling in that light, I think that in some ways it's superior, a blue glass, to a lapis lazuli, which has more of a matte finish. Yes, it has the glint of gold in it, but the lapis lazuli, the real stuff. And the Egyptians were keen, the royalty was keen to say in their commemorative documentation that they were using real lapis lazuli, emal, right? Building something anew rather than reusing it or using the fake stuff. So I think glass does have its own special category to highlight color more than simple paints and minerals could even do.
It's an excellent point. And so all of this, of course, is more complicated than what we can touch on in one podcast episode. But it gives you an idea of how interesting this idea of color and art, that either the presence of color, absence of color, all of it says something. But one thing that I did want to touch on and discuss, just because it's something that is always, it's a question that I constantly roll over in my mind, especially given my experience in museums, and that is looking at not just the objects in a museum, but the museum itself as a space of reuse. Because a lot of times, sometimes I wouldn't talk about the museum itself, but say you're looking at one individual sculpture, like say the sculpture of Heracles at the Getty Villa. I loved to talk about object life stories, right? And as we look at it today, is it an ancient sculpture or is it, has it become modern art? Because it's now in a museum. And where do you make that cutoff? Because it's had an entire life. It's had an ancient life. It's had an 18th century life, 19th century, and now into the 21st century. And so, and then, of course, given your research on reuse, I just wanted to look at museums as spaces of reuse.
Well, it was an artist named Jill Moniz, who works in a Los Angeles art collective, who told me that she sees museums as killing spaces. And that settled somewhere in my heart. I had seen museums as political spaces, ownership spaces, spaces of connoisseurship and fetishization, spaces of power, spaces for elites to throw around their money and give big donations and give big antiquity purchases that they had made and bequeath them and have their names in the wing or whatever. I mean, these are spaces of power. But for her, and she's a Black American artist looking at antiquity and how it's been moved into these spaces and noticing how most of the antiquity in these spaces was ritually and religiously alive in its ancient context. And much of it would still be ritually and religiously alive in their home countries of origin if they had not been removed. And our dear listeners can Google there. This was like 2 years ago. There was a dancer, and this was a performative art piece that she did. She went to the Met and she danced in front of an ancient piece of art. And I don't remember the nationality or the person or the details. So you can try to Google that.
I read the article. I remember it. Yeah.
Oh, good. And she was arrested for doing this, but she was essentially worshiping the object that was put into this museum space as she thought it should be worshiped and would still be worshiped if it was in her home country of origin and used in its original way. So to see a museum as a killing space, and that sounds pretty harsh. And I know many of our listeners work in museums and love museums and treasure them and see them as spaces of education and spaces where the young mind can be opened up. And I do agree with you. I have this same complicated ambivalence about the museum space as what it meant to me as a young person and how I look at it with side eye now and have some issues, but you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, or do you? But it's this idea of the museum as a killing space. When I look at an Egyptian object or a Greek statue, what does its emplacement within the space mean? I mean, if somebody said, okay, we're giving the Parthenon marbles back, right? The Parthenon cannot make it a living object again. They're not allowed by morals and ethics of the fetishization of these objects as objects that have been ritually killed, that cannot change and be altered, that cannot degrade, that cannot be used, they cannot be manipulated. The Greek government cannot put these back on the Parthenon building. And nor would they ever dream of then painting them. Like, you can imagine the uproar, right? We just went through the uproar of the third pyramid in the Giza Plateau, the smallest one, supposedly being reclad in granite stones. And how was one going to do this? And people freaked out as if the antiquity was theirs, because this object needs to stay in its status quo as it is, having been ritually killed of its life. And so, even if those objects go back, the Greek government has already built a museum. There is a Parthenon Marbles Museum ready to go to take them in, to explain to the viewer. It's right next to the Parthenon itself. But isn't it interesting that it can't be on the living structure anymore once removed? To restitute it to its place is not to put it back on the building. It is to hermetically seal it, ritually kill it, and put it into a separate place away from what it was. Because no one is worshiping, well, not many people are worshiping at the Parthenon, worshiping Athena in her goddess form. I'm sure there's some people doing this, and there must be. But because this is not a real part of Greek life, having become Christianized, it's not something that the culture would demand to do. But another object leaving a museum would go back to a temple space and probably be repainted and get milk poured over it.
Yeah, I absolutely take your point, and I agree. Obviously, killing space is a charged way to describe the museum space, not necessarily unmerited in certain contexts, but I think that there is a distinction between those objects that are associated with cultures that are still within living memory or are living cultures today, and say an ancient Egyptian sculpture. Not saying that it shouldn't go back to Egypt, but saying if you did take it back to that temple context, you cannot reinstate that original ancient temple context. There are no priests, worshipers that would be there to place it into that original religious context, because that culture is gone.
But also, as you say, it's been reused, because putting it into the museum changes it.
it gives it a different cachet. It turns it into something that's now part of our art history volumes. It's been pictured. It's a celebrity.
It further divorces it from its original context. But if we're going to get really purist about it, you can't, as a viewer, reconstruct how an ancient viewer would see the sculpture or feel about the sculpture, interact with the sculpture, because that is gone. It's in the past, never to be reclaimed.
Well, it could be reclaimed, though. Like, the Parthenon is so interesting to me because you could put those pieces back up where you think they're meant to be. But there would be a public moral outcry against doing such a thing, against putting those objects into pollution, into the living petrochemical realm of the human, because by doing that, the piece is no longer preserved to last forever. Once it goes into the museum, then it's like it's got a new status, as in you better keep it safe. You fucking use it, we have trouble. There is no use assigned to these pieces except to view from a distance, to publish if you're lucky, yes, from a distance. Yeah.
And this is what I'm talking about, this life story of these objects, because it inevitably has to have a life story. It has to change, because if it's an object that's around for millennia, right? Mm-hmm. Inevitably, this ebb and flow of time, it's going to change. Yeah. Even within the span of what we traditionally think of as ancient Egyptian culture, we're talking about centuries. So a sculpture created in the Old Kingdom, let's say it survives to the New Kingdom, it would be seen and interacted with in a different way. Just like a text written in the Old Kingdom would be read and interpreted and interacted with in a different way in the New Kingdom, right?
Yeah. And I think the interaction you can see, and just to bring it back to color, you know, if you go to the Met and you stand in front of Hatshepsut's most famous statue, her indurated white limestone statue, devoid of color, pure white, this is really a highlight of the Metropolitan Museum of Art collection because of its whiteness, because it's not a Hatshepsut piece in granodiorite or red granite, which are in many ways harder for the viewer to take in. The occlusions in the stone impede a purity of view. They don't understand what it is exactly they're looking at. The paint would have helped in a sense, but there's no paint really left. Sometimes you could see remnants of it, but this white statue pieced together by conservators, did it have remnants of paint on it? Almost certainly, yes, but there are none there now. And what viewers also may not know when they stand in front of this indurated white limestone piece of Hatshepsut, which shows her with the bare chest, but she has the slight breasts, and it's her most androgynous piece where she's male and female simultaneously, wearing no shirt and wearing just the masculine kilt and the royal nemes, but not showing herself as a woman, but kind of showing the gracility and the hints of breasts and all the things that would be. She looks immediately like a woman when you look at her, but she's dressed like a man. But the viewer may not know that piece has been heavily reconstructed, that the face is half gone. And the conservators in the 30s and 40s, and I don't know exactly when the piece was put back together, I would have to talk to that curatorial team, but when they put that piece back together, they matched it impeccably. They matched it perfectly so that you have an unimpeded view of a perfectly beautiful Barbie-like, wide-eyed Disney princess face. And she is the epitome of a gracile feminine beauty that we appreciate. And it fits with our neoclassical or Renaissance statuary aesthetic in the Western world. And I don't think the Western audience, the same way that if they saw it painted, they'd be like, don't do that. Don't ruin that statue. In the same way, they also wouldn't want half the face removed. They, I think, would be like, don't take that reconstruction away from the piece. It would ruin it. Kind of like the Getty Villas, Leto and the Swan, which they're very honest about, has been restored within an inch of its life and is mostly neoclassical marble that's been added to it. And if you took it all away, the antiquity that would be left would be very slight. Well, the Hatshepsut situation is not that bad, but people would rebel. They would
and
not.
This is part of my point, because it is at once, as you say, a reconstruction and a reuse in our present day. But as a way to teach or educate the public about this ancient culture, it's not going to be as useful in pieces as it would be reconstructed and put together. And let's also point out that a lot of these, like Leda and the Swan that you talk about at the Getty, they have reconstructed it, quote unquote, in a conservationally responsible way, right? As yeah, in yeah. they could take it apart and the ancient pieces would not be affected or damaged in any way. It's not a 19th century reconstruction, right?
Right.
This is part of what I'm getting at in that it's complicated. And I absolutely see museums as spaces of reuse. And the question that I always debate in my own mind is, are we wrong to have these spaces of reuse? Because there are obvious colonialist origins to the idea of a museum itself. Mm-hmm. And yet I have had years of personal experience seeing the benefit of museums as spaces of education, talking mm-hmm. about this color in ancient sculpture. Color reconstruction is a powerful educational tool yeah. because it got people or it gets people emotionally engaged. They're immediately there with you. Their emotions are engaged. And so now they're going to be a part of this conversation that you're having. And they're going to yeah. leave the museum and they're going to be thinking about ancient art and ancient cultures in ways that they have not before. And yeah. so it's a question of the benefit versus the pros versus the cons, which side of the scale is heavier, or how do we try to or make an attempt to balance the scales a little right. bit more responsibly than we have in the past?
Yeah. And just thinking about how you're bringing up museums as spaces of reuse, it's very important for the museum to not usually try to replicate the space that it would have been in antiquity. And so you go into a space that is a neoclassical, modern, or modernist type building, usually with white walls. Maybe there'll be another color, but normally it's like a muted color, a muted blue, or a muted red tone. I mean, there are colors, but usually it's white walls, and then the pieces are set against those white walls. And I'm reminded of how, you know, driving in the city of LA, this home of the homeless, as you're driving around and you see the graffiti of the resistance, the graffiti of the poor, like on those high-rise buildings downtown that are abandoned by some company when they went bankrupt. And you've got these buildings for the rich that have been tagged within an inch of their life, and how colorful, how incredibly colorful that graffiti is, and how colorful spaces of the poor often are in our urban spaces, and how stark and white and clean the space of the elite, the wealthy, the rich. You can't have a bright blue house in a really nice zoned, controlled neighborhood. They're not going to let you. So we still think of color, particularly in our museum spaces, as something that needs to be curated and done with taste.
Well, it is. It's designed. They have yeah. exhibition designers that come in. Your preps team comes in and they design these spaces. You're absolutely right. And also, frankly, I know of scholars who work in museums, curators, that kind of thing. They kind of tolerate the public mm-hmm. having the masses come in and mingle with this elevated art, this elevated space. So there's definitely a bit of an attitude like that that I have myself witnessed.
Oh my God, I have that attitude. I was just in the Fitzwilliam I went to both, but I was at the Ashmolean in Oxford, and I'm looking at this piece, this Kawa shrine, and a member of the public comes up to it and just puts her hand right on it and just starts like—
Okay, yeah, well, now that is crossing a
right?
line.
But so how interesting that the public refuses, and everyone in a museum knows this. This is why we have guards standing in every room, don't touch the piece. Everyone wants to go in and touch the piece. They want to make the piece alive. Every museum
wants ownership.
They want ownership. And every museum is dealing with this tension between what the public who comes in wants from the piece and what the piece is allowed to give you according to those who own it. And that is so damn interesting that people are like, no, I get to touch this. There's no case on it. I get to do this.
Hey, dude, I can't even tell you the incidents that I have witnessed, right? I mean, yep. Getty shakes down every visitor now that comes in for Sharpies.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Because they've had problems in the past. And so absolutely, these museums are spaces where not just the people who form them and run them can cross a line or treat it in a poor way, but so can the visitors. Very true. But again, does that mean it's wrong to have them or that we should get rid of them? The idea is you need to take that person who's touching that sculpture and make them a
person. Oh, I talked to her.
Oh, I'm sure you had words. I'm sure you had words.
Like, don't touch them. Don't touch.
So, yeah, but this is the thing. And it's a hard position to be in because it gets complicated, especially having cultural discussions in present day. But if we're not having these conversations, how are we going to be better, so to speak? So,
and how crazy that the act of resistance that one so often sees in these spaces of power is to add color to the piece. They sharpie the piece. They throw paint on the piece. They do something to the piece that makes it somehow.
Well, hey, yeah. You know, Kara, it's funny that you should say, use that term, like acts of resistance, because I was working on a thing I was writing last weekend. And I was reflecting, looking back, because what I was looking at, I had written while I was working as a museum educator. So it was all in the present tense. So I was reflecting on it and trying to bring it up to present day. And I thought to myself, like, my acts of resistance used to be in museum galleries, yeah, right? In front of the public, talking to them, just having conversations, bringing up difficult issues or this discussion of color in ancient art, challenging their ideas, yeah, provoking new perspectives.
Now
my acts of resistance are on podcasts like this and Substack and this sort of thing. But it's so funny because that is the phrase that came to my mind, is this act of resistance.
Yeah.
So obviously I was not high in the hierarchy, so to speak, but I sure as hell was in the trenches.
Yeah.
And I definitely felt like any given day I could have talked to 75, 200 people. And on any given day, I knew that a good percentage of them were walking away from their conversation with me, having new ideas about mm-hmm. ancient art mm-hmm. and the ancient world. And to me, that was worth it. That was enough justification to, okay, these spaces can be problematic, but they can also be worth it and maybe even necessary.
I mean, Amber, if adding color to something is enlivening, which is, I think, perfect the way you phrase that, making something come to life. So much of my work is trying to make the ancient past come to life and say, oh, Hatshepsut, she would have made decisions in this way. She would have thought in this way, maybe not, but maybe. And oh, Nefertiti would have thought in this way, maybe. And Ramses II too. And what? There is nothing that pisses off the establishment more than
maybe.
Than the enlivening, the adding color, the trying to bring it back to life. It pisses people off. They want them contained. They want them in hermetically sealed cases, glass cases, no one can touch. And they're there fetishized forever. And you don't fuck with them. You don't mess with them. You don't say, maybe Ramses II should be thought of as an autocratic dictator. Maybe we should think of things in this way. That people don't want to. And it is that very process of pulling the past into the present. And that's why our Substack is called Ancient Now. I think that is perceived by many in the scholarly world as so subversive. And why, if you're going to stay safe in the scholarly world, you do safe data-driven things that talk nothing about what the object means. You just talk about what the object is. And it's descriptive and it's boring as anything I could ever think of. But
oh no, how many articles or books have you read where you get to the end of it and you're like, wait, but what did you say?
I don't get to the end of those. I just look at the pictures and I'm like, oh my God, I've just read another copy of the book. I just look at the pictures and I kind of skim around and then look for the information. I mean, I've read a lot of books.
Now, kids, you're supposed to read the whole thing.
I know. If it's really boring, move on to another book.
Actually, you know what I do? I read the first paragraph, last paragraph of every chapter and like the intro and the conclusion. And then that usually gets you the right idea, unless it's a great writer. And then I'll read the whole thing.
Yeah. Then you're there for it.
This was a super interesting discussion. And
oh my God,
I think
fun.
We should get into it a little bit more. Maybe we can, like you said, revisit symbolism and color.
Well, yeah, because we could talk about things like the so-called monochrome tombs at Deir el-Medina and how they're all basically this light yellow that's supposed to be like gold. And what's the symbolism of that? That
your article cool. on light and how that plays with color. And I think that we absolutely have a lot to talk about on that score as well. So I think people should stay tuned for more talk of color.
Where for the Egyptians, purity. For the Egyptians, purity is not white, it is gold.
It's true, but it can be white as well, right? With the linen. So
it's light. It's light. It's all the colors put together, right? Isn't that what white is? And then the gold is kind of the same thing. It's light. That's what they worship. And that's color. Without light, you have no color. And there we come full circle. I love it.
Well, thank you for indulging me in this conversation.
My pleasure. It was fun. Super fun, as always, Amber. And I'll let you take us out. So, Amber, what podcast are we listening to?
This is Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Thank you so much. Take care, everyone.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack Ancient Now at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for @Karakuni. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.